The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again in yet another summery week. If the very thought of summer evokes for you the thwack of leather on willow, stay with us. If the shout of how's that is more likely to send you pedalling furiously in the opposite direction, we've got something for you too. I have to confess that I'm more likely to flake out with a good book on the village green than to spend hours watching all those men in white running around. So I've called in our cricket correspondent Andy Bull to examine some of the myths of the great game with one of the editors of the impressive Cambridge Companion to Cricket, Anthony Bateman. But just to prove that I'm not sports phobic, I've been out on my bike with Bella Bathurst talking about her latest book, and guess what it's about.
You have to say who you belong to. You're either a kind of, you know, you're an urban cyclist, and even within an urban cycle, are you a fakinger, are you a kind of true messenger, or are you a keen on fixie?
Cricket, lovely cricket, at last where I saw it. Cricket, lovely cricket, at last where I saw it. Yardley tried his best, Goddard won the test. They gave the crowd plenty fun, the second test and West Indies won. With those little pals of mine,
we English have such a romantic idea of the game. Matt Hill went to chat to some of the crowd at Lord's.
Sum up cricket in five words.
It's fascinating.
The Ashes, we were there
the
when they won.
Lots of drinking and plenty of hot weather and
lovely and sunny.
There's a very, very good book published recently, J.M. Barrie, who had a cricket team.
Yeah, we read the Lord's cricket book last night before we came here.
Bradman's.
Donald Bradman's books.
Where he names his super team.
And a few of the autobiographies.
Ian Botham's biography I've read.
And Ian Botham.
I've read the Ian Botham book.
Dickie Bird's book.
Geoffrey Boycott's book.
Sunil Gavaskar's book.
I've had a look at the Wisden Almanac or whatever it's called, yes, but not in great detail.
I used to get it quite often, yeah, particularly out of libraries. Well, not every year.
You do see people from time to time, filling in the programmes and so on.
I mean, the older generation did, and it was they kept them and they'd bring them into the museum sometimes and show us what they'd done, and they haven't done it, but not anymore.
Can I really have heard that right? J.M. Barrie? Indeed I did. Apparently, Barrie was a hugely enthusiastic cricketer of very little talent who led a writer's side between 1890 and 1913 that included most of the greats of Edwardian English literature. People like A.A. Milne, P.G. Woodhouse, Jerome K. Jerome and Arthur Conan Doyle. So my first question to Anthony Bateman before I hand over to Andy Bull is, which of these was the best player and which were the boobies?
Most of them were boobies. But the one player who does stand out, rather the one author who stands out, is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who played quite a lot of cricket when he had time. Now, he actually took one very important wicket, that of W.G. Grace himself. And he later wrote a poem about the experience.
Was it a good poem or a bad poem?
Not terribly good, no.
Not terribly good. In my experience, and I may be being terribly rude here, cricketing poetry tends to be rather bad. But we'll come on to that a little bit later.
Yeah. But the greatest writer, cricketer, would be not an Englishman at all, an Irishman, Samuel Beckett, who is actually recorded in Wisden as taking a number of first-class wickets for Trinity College Dublin against Northamptonshire, I think.
Of course, he was also a cyclist. So you've actually delivered us the missing link in this podcast, which is okay. Samuel Beckett.
Okay.
How's that for literary? Good. If you're anyone who's interested in the J.M. Barrie book, it's called Peter Pan's First 11, and it's just out now, I think. I'm now going to hand over to Andy Bull, who's sitting there patiently, to ask all the serious probing questions that I don't know about.
Yeah, well, actually, J.M. Barrie was a real duffer, wasn't he?
He was,
an enthusiastic duffer. He told his team once, before they played their matches, he'd say to the team, whatever you do, don't practice on the ground of the opposition before the match, because that's only going to give them confidence. Your book, though, very different kind of book to anything J.M. Barrie, right, obviously. But I've been really enjoying reading it this last week. And I guess we'll begin at the beginning, which is where you start trying to find the history of English cricket, isn't it? And you delve right way back into the past.
Yes, one of our contributors, Rob Light, has actually done a PhD on 18th century cricket, and he's written a very interesting chapter on the subject. I mean, the thing that interests me about the beginnings of cricket are, you know, when we start to talk about organised cricket with articles of agreement and then laws, the reason why these came into being were because of gambling. You had to have set out practice of a game itself, that you can bet on, that you can gamble on. And so there was a game that had been really a folk game at the beginning of the 18th century, was sort of really appropriated by aristocrats and, you know, the emerging business classes, and used as a means of gambling.
It's fascinating, that, isn't it? Because I think most people in this country have the idea that cricket started as a very noble game.
Yes.
Which is perhaps quite a Victorian idea. But in actual fact, as history goes back beyond that, as quite a rogue sport in a way.
Absolutely. You know, a sport that for a long time before the 18th century was prescribed. It was even illegal, and it, certainly to play on the Sabbath would have been unheard of. It started with this rough, really quite rough origins, with a lot of gambling and sometimes quite a lot of violence as well. But it was the Victorians who cleaned it up, rewrote cricket into what we perhaps now think of this noble game of gentlemen.
There's a lovely slight diversion here, actually, but do you know Flashman's Lady, the book by George MacDonald Fraser?
I do.
There's a very good cricket match in that, isn't there?
There is.
Which really captures, because of course he was meticulous with his research.
Yeah.
And he really captures that idea of it being quite a corrupt sport, doesn't he?
He does. And of course there's the irony there that Flashman was a character in Thomas Hughes's Tom Bowne School Days.
Exactly.
Which, you know, in a way was the defining text of cricket. C.L.R. James called Tom Bowne School Days the sacred text of Victorianism.
And that's really where we come onto this idea of how cricket became this supposedly noble sport that we now think it is, isn't it? Through that kind of Victorian idea that this was a muscular and healthy and moral thing to do.
Well, I think a number of things happened. There was the public schools were cleaned up in the early 19th century. They were pretty roguish places. If you read Lord Byron's letters, you get an idea of what these public schools were like before they were reformed. But they were reformed, I guess, in the first decades of the 19th century. And cricket was then taken on board as an important part of the curriculum. And so along with cricket just being a means of keeping boys fit and maybe doing something with their sexual desires, etc., it was given this kind of ideology, this idea of moral manhood. It wasn't just a game, it had a moral code attached to it. And so you get a lot of writing in the middle of the 19th century which is desperately trying to redefine cricket and distance itself from this old popular, cultural, rough kind of game that it was. So there's that, and of course there's also the religious groups, particularly the evangelicals, opposed cricket initially, but it was becoming so popular by the sort of 1860s and 1870s that they had absolutely no, that they couldn't oppose it, they had to go along with it. So then you get even clerics writing about cricket and saying that it's a Christian game, and then the rise of muscular Christianity in writers like Thomas Hughes and Charles Kingsley, who sort of argued that if you were healthy in body, you were healthy in mind and healthy in spirit, and cricket really was the sort of regarded as the most important game within that muscular Christianity. So it had been hugely transformed within 100 years.
Byron's actually quite a keen cricketer himself, wasn't he?
Yes, and he was instrumental in organising the first Eton Harrow games. And his letters are hilarious because he talks about all the cricketers, both sides, going out and getting drunk after the match and then going to the theatre and causing mayhem there.
I mean, he's probably an example of a writer who was actually quite good at cricket. As we go on a little bit further on, we get, as you say, maybe in the golden age of cricket, which we talk about, which is the kind of early 20th century. And again, we have those kinds of writers who were playing with J.M. Barrie, who was an absolute duffer at cricket. Again, writing about cricket in a slightly different way. The likes of Woodhouse and Siegfried Sassoon wrote a bit about cricket as well. It becomes a very comedic thing, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, certainly with Woodhouse it does, although I personally prefer his golfing stories. I think they're superior. With Sassoon, I don't know with Sassoon. I'd say that Sassoon takes it pretty seriously. I think the Flower Show match, which perhaps you're thinking of, some of his poems, I think they're really quite interesting literary texts that tell us about a sort of mindset that came after the First World War, that there was this huge sense of elegising a lost England after the First World War, the huge loss of life, particularly of sort of middle-class and upper-middle-class men. People like Sassoon and his friend Edmund Blunden, who was later to write a book called Cricket Country during the Second World War, really had this strong sense of this passing of an old England, and I think they wrote about cricket as something that was at its peak in the Edwardian age before the First World War, and there's an awful lot of this writing in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, we're very prone to that kind of nostalgia in England, aren't we?
Absolutely, and particularly when we talk about cricket. the same time in the interwar period, Neville Cardus began to write for this newspaper.
You can't say a bad word about Cardus in this building, obviously.
No, I'm afraid I have written bad things about Neville Cardus, so perhaps I should leave now.
One of the other writers who used to write for this newspaper, a great writer of cricket from a different school of writing, is C.L.R. James.
Yes.
Who was given his first start by Cardus, actually, wasn't he?
He was. C.L.R. James came over to England in 1933. One of his first jobs was as Cardus's assistant. Cardus encouraged him a great deal. So when Cardus was writing on the test matches, I believe James wrote on county cricket. And then he later wrote for the Glasgow Herald as well.
And we have this interesting contrast here between the English school of being very nostalgic, very Cardus-like.
Yes.
And then C.L.R. James, who's a much more radical man from the West Indies.
Yeah.
And really, he comes from a very different school of writing and thinking about cricket, doesn't he?
Well, he does and he doesn't. I think he does come at it, to use a baseball term, very much from left field, politically from the left as well. But he doesn't completely break with tradition. I think James understood more than anyone. You know, Theodore Adorno talked about the need to understand tradition properly, or hating it properly, and James certainly did. He understood what all this was about, and to a certain extent he was very much a cricketing traditionalist. He totally bought into the idea of fair play. When he was in America, he hated the fact that there was a corruption case in baseball. He couldn't believe it. He's very much a conservative in many ways, but of course he was a Marxist. And what he kind of did was to take this notion of the even playing field, the level playing field, and kind of dialectically incorporate it into this kind of Marxist idea of cricket.
And that's such a fascinating thing, isn't it? I mean, in the West Indies, perhaps cricket's been far more political than it has been in England, and James really exemplifies that.
Absolutely. Beyond a Boundary works on many different levels. One of them is very much political. And one of the things he does is he shows that in his native Trinidad, he talks about the structure of club cricket in Trinidad, and he shows the way that the different clubs, which were for different castes, people with different colour skins, and people from different social classes. So, for instance, he was a member of one club because he was a brown-skinned man, but his friend Leary Constantine, who was a Catholic, lower-middle-class man, joined a different club. And so he talks about this in terms of how this replicated the sort of colonialist idea of divide and rule. On the other hand, because he's being a Marxist, he talks about cricket being a means of racial liberation at the same time. And the way that by the late 19th century, you know, West Indies actually had a multiracial team, which was kind of showing the world the very opposite of what was happening in South Africa at that time.
Some people would say the English are probably still stuck in this nostalgic mindset, while the rest of the world has maybe moved on. And in the same way, perhaps India is now seen as the most important country in cricket, isn't it? How much have you looked at Indian cricket literature in your book, then?
We had to look at Indian cricket quite a lot, but there's no doubt that it's now the political and economic power base of world cricket, and it has very much become so in a fairly short period of time. It's a very fascinating story, I think. You know, in the early 1980s, cricket was no more popular in India than were, say, hockey and football. And then they win the World Cup in 83. And then the various factors come into play. The liberalisation of the Indian economy it encourages a lot of investment and money, of course satellite TV, and cricket just takes off exponentially in that part of the world.
And are there particular Indian cricket writers you like and admire?
Having read Prashant Kadambi's contribution to our volume, he'd certainly be high up on my list. He's also written the current edition of Wisden as well on Sachin Tendulkar, so he'd be high up. I admire greatly Mihir Bose, and also, well, he's perhaps not fully Indian in a sense, you know, but the historian Ramachandra Guha, I think, has written a very fine history of Indian cricket.
Yes, I've just read his book, actually, A Corner of a Foreign Field.
Yeah, superb, isn't it?
For anyone who's interested in modern Indian history, whether you like cricket or not.
Absolutely, yeah. He's more than a cricket historian. He's a real proper social historian who uses cricket to explore things beyond the boundary, yeah.
And how about sort of Australia? I guess I was asking, a lot of the great Australian cricket writers at the moment are actually English, which I should be careful about saying, because it's the kind of thing that Australian listeners will get very upset with me for saying. But it's true, isn't it?
Certainly two of the best are Anglo-Australians, i.e. David Frith, who we're very, very pleased to have a chapter by in our collection, and Gideon Haigh, who are definitely two of the finest, and not afraid of controversy either.
Exactly. And one of the things I really liked about your book, you have a similar mindset, really. You really seem to be challenging a lot of the orthodoxies of cricket.
Yes.
For example, the essay on Don Bradman in there is actually, I mean, Don Bradman, if you don't know, is the great hero of Australian cricket. It's almost a negative portrait.
It is quite a negative portrait. It certainly suggests that Bradman was not the saintly figure that he's made out to be in Australian popular culture. He's shown to be a pretty mercenary figure, and he's certainly shown not to be a team man, and very, very insecure man as well, which is quite surprising, but also very conscious of his status as a middle-class Protestant and a Freemason, and a man who therefore did not get on with the Irish Catholics and the Australian team at all. Very much a pro-imperialist figure, but that shouldn't be held against him in any way. But of course, during Bodyline in the 1932 and 33, there was an awful lot of tension between Irish Catholics like Jack Fingleton, Bill O'Reilly, who were not afraid to be oppositional towards what was happening, and Bradman, the loyalist Protestant, who didn't want to ruffle things too much.
And was that something you were deliberately trying to do with this book, to sort of challenge what you might call myths of cricket?
Yes, I think it was. I mean, we're not the first to do it. There's actually been more work along these lines than people perhaps realise. The problem, one of the problems is, it's a lot of it is in rather obscure academic journals and very expensive books. I've written a book myself, but I'm afraid it cost £55. It sold about 10 copies in the last year. Maybe it's not very good.
One of my favourite chapters in it, actually, was I'd assumed, much like Claire, that all cricket poetry was terrible, mm-hmm. having read quite a lot. But a lovely chapter in your book on Caribbean cricket yes. poetry.
If the truth is told, most English cricket poetry is doggerel. You know, there are a few exceptions. I mean, I'm a bit of a sucker for Francis Thompson's At Lord's. I mean, it's very nostalgic, always painfully so, but I do think it has a certain beauty. And, of course, people like John Arlott, also this newspaper at one time, wrote some lovely poems on cricket. But I think there's a really interesting sort of post-C.L.R. James tradition of Caribbean cricket poetry that Claire Westall writes about wonderfully in the book. It's really very fine. And she's not just analysing the words on the page, which, are, as you say, are very effective, but she's putting it into a kind of political context. She's using these poems to show just how iconic players like Brian Lara were before him, Viv Richards. In fact, a whole line of Caribbean cricketers such as Constantine Sobers, and how they were celebrated really wonderfully in these poems.
Another particular favourite of mine was actually Rob Steen's section on yes. the history of writing cricket, which is hard not to like, because he seems to go through most of the people who have written about cricket for The Guardian.
And including you, Andy.
He doesn't quite get to me, I'm afraid. He stops just short with a colleague of mine called David Hopps, and says how much he enjoys them and how wonderful they all are. Which is music to our ears.
Yes, that's a very positive piece. But it nevertheless does draw sort of... It talks about colonial cricket, the post-imperial age has kind of opened up cricket writing and made it more democratic.
Can I ask a couple of layperson's questions here? One is, how does the literature of cricket compare with the literature of other sports? So this is for both of you, really. Is there much more of it? Is it better, worse?
Definitely in terms of quantity, there's more of it. Quality, I think it probably is not as high as, say, a sport like boxing.
Boxing is traditionally the other great sport that people have written about. Norman Mailer wrote a very famous book about boxing called The Fight. The thing with cricket, I think, that it has that's different to other sports is it's attracted a lot of people who have been great writers in their own life, away from cricket, who just happen to love the sport and have therefore written a bit about it. So Harold Pinter would be a good example. V.S. Naipaul.
Another person who had his own cricket team, didn't he? The Gaieties. How good were they?
I don't believe they were of any great standard. No,
he did. I mean, he had a great weakness for cricket and poetry as well, of course.
Oh, yes. We received a few of those on The Guardian. They used to stutter out of the fax machine every now and then. We'd say, oh, my goodness, no, Harold, please don't.
Well, he famously, one of his most famous cricket poems, he came up with in a flash of inspiration, and he sent it off to 30 of his friends, and it said simply, I saw Len Hutton in his prime, another time, another time. He sent this out to 30 of his friends, as I say, and a week later, he called up Simon Gray, who's one of the people who'd sent it to, and said, well, Simon, what did you think of my poem? And Simon said, well, I'm sorry, Harold, I haven't finished it yet.
didn't Harold disown Simon Gray and tell all his friends to cut him dead as well after that? For a while.
I can believe it.
A good story anyway. I believe it.
Even that three-line poem, it's very nostalgic, isn't it?
Yeah. Very. Well, his great piece on cricket is Hutton and the Past, which is a lovely, lovely piece of writing, but again, it's very nostalgic.
Yeah. One last question. We've already got Wisden, that's known as the Bible. Do we have a need for another cricketing Bible?
Obviously, Wisden's an annual almanac that comes out every spring at the beginning of the English cricket season. It's full of statistics, not just statistics though. There are obituaries, there are opinion pieces. It's a huge tome. I think 1,600 pages this year. I think what we've tried to do is something really quite different from that. It's a book that you can just delve into, read an essay here, an essay there. But we hope it's just going to be perhaps a little bit. Not to say that Wisden isn't stimulating. Wisden's a hugely enjoyable read, and it also is increasingly including essays of the sort that we've published. But I think we just wanted to be a little bit more off the beaten track.
I'm going to have a second last question to both of you, put you on the spot. Okay. Your desert island cricket book, what would it be, each of you? Andy, come to you first.
Well, it'd be tempting to say Beyond the Boundary, which we've been talking about, by C.L.R. James, simply because there's a lot in it to get your head around. Actually, I think I'd rather go for a compilation of someone called Robertson Glasgow, who's known as Crusoe, who's probably the wittiest of English cricket writers. He's a very funny man.
Yes, it would be Beyond the Boundary, but if not Beyond the Boundary, that would be the Bible, wouldn't it? You
could take. We have agreement. This is very rare in any sporting event, in any discussion of any sport, isn't it?
Yeah, it is unusual. It would be Beyond the Boundary, but it might also be David Underdown's Start of Play, which is a wonderful account of cricket in the 18th century, written by a former Yale historian who didn't write a cricket book until he'd retired from academia because he was too worried that he would get looked down on.
Well, thank you very much both for coming in. And the Cambridge Companion to Cricket is published by Cambridge University Press.
West Indies then had 220 lead. Brother said that is nice indeed. With those little pals of mine. Yardley wasn't broken hearted when the second inning started. Jenkins was like a target, getting the first five into his basket. But Gomez broke him down, while Walker flicked them around. He was not out for 168, leaving Yardley to contemplate. The bowling was super fine.
Now, it's a sport, it's a hobby, and it's a form of transport. What is it? Well, we've given that away already. It's that wonderful machine, the bicycle. And I was delighted and just a little bit jealous to discover that it's the subject of Bella Bathurst's latest book. Jealous because the bicycle book is just the book I would have liked to have written if The Guardian were to ever give me time off to do such things. I met Bella on the towpath of the Regent's Canal in North London to see if it was possible to conduct an interview on two wheels while dodging ducks and joggers and, of course, all those other cyclists. Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle. Thank you. We're standing here just outside our office in King's Place on the canal. Bella, you've just cycled here through St Pancras Cemetery, because one of the things about cycling is that you get to discover all these things about the place that you live in that you wouldn't know otherwise.
You suddenly come across the old St Pancras Church, which has got this extraordinary thing. When they were building the railway originally, Thomas Hardy, who was then an apprentice architect, was designated to go and exhume some of the gravestones that were going to be in the way of the railway. And so he put them around the base of an ash tree, and 100 years have passed. The tree has grown up and the roots have grown into the gravestones. And there is now this extraordinary, beautiful sort of fan shape all the way around the base of the tree.
I'm a bit disappointed that you're not riding the bicycle with which you opened the book, which is your lovely blood-red racer, which you hand-built yourself. Why have you got this old, scuzzy old black thing?
I took the beautiful blood-red thing up to Scotland because I found that the beautiful Blood Red Thing was so beautiful that it never got written because inevitably I'd never wanted to tie it up outside because I was worried it would get nicked.
Now, the chapter I think I almost like best, your chapter about Holland, I thought was really wonderful.
Yes, I think the Dutch have just, they were faced with exactly the same issues that we had in the 70s, you know, sort of big car lobby and lots more car use. But they took the other decision. They decided to go for cycles instead. So it is cycling nirvana, even more so because obviously it's pancake flat. So you can construct a very heavy, very solid, very stately, rather kind of gentlemanly bike, and you can just kind of hoddle along with kind of three gears, and you know, you can cycle to the ends of the earth on it. I mean, it's just glorious. So it's just totally different to the British understanding of what a bicycle is and what it's for.
The Dutch are the sensible ones, and what is bizarre is our attitude in the UK to the bike. We have all these rather oddball biking communities that you discovered during your researches, don't we?
Yes, I mean, cycling is very tribal, certainly in the UK. So, you know, it's almost like you have to kind of stake your position. You have to say who you belong to. You're either a kind of, you know, you're an urban cyclist, and even within an urban cycle, are you a Fakinger, are you a kind of true messenger, or are you a keen on fixies, you know?
Fixies, what are those? That's
fixed
jargon. you're into the jargon. You're
well,
enough of a geek to have the jargon.
No. This is an observational jargon, I think. But I mean, it is so kind of rarefied and, as I say, tribal, that it feels very odd. You know, so even within mountain biking, it kind of divides into kind of four separate sections and that sort of thing. And to anybody else in kind of different parts of Europe, that's incomprehensible. You have a bike, it's useful. And this kind of whole, you know, you must cycle in the appropriate way with the appropriate clothing at the appropriate speed with it's just odd.
Tell me about your conversations with cab drivers and couriers. You had two separate conversations which you record in the book.
They were completely hilarious. I mean, it had to be said that going and asking a bunch of cabbies what they think about cycling, there were very few surprises. I kind of think I can see their point. It is, you know, they drive a cab for a living. They really feel a very strong sense of ownership about London. And so cyclists and, you know, all other kind of vehicles are incredibly annoying sometimes. They do stupid and annoying things.
And they get their bonnets banged, don't they?
They get their bonnets banged, exactly. They get, you know, score lines down.
By cyclists, these road
yes,
cyclists.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't realise there was this thing with the old cabs that you could do if kind of cyclists used to hold on to the petrol cap and get tugged along. You'd take your free ride on a cab, which is somehow even more offensive.
Then you go and meet a load of couriers in a pub very close to the cafe where you met the cab drivers, and they actually they did conform to this behaviour, didn't they, some of them?
Some do, some don't. I mean, the couriers who've managed to survive and who've been doing it successfully for a long time, A, they're very skillful and they can really, really ride better than anyone, and B, by that stage they're just mellowed. I mean, if you're going to kind of ride out and pick a fight with anyone you meet every single day of your working life, then you're not going to survive. Even if you didn't meet some hideous accident, you would probably burn out from sheer rage beforehand.
Now, this book actually did involve some quite dangerous research, didn't it? Not least driving a bicycle rickshaw for hire in India.
One of the things that kind of fascinates me is actually you need much greater agility than if you're on a kind of incredibly high-spec, fantastic, blah, 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 blah racing bike. So it was a fascinating thing to have done, and I think a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
One of the best stories in the book is the story of poor old Charlie Wigelius, what the journeymen of racing get up to. Tell us a little bit about him.
Charlie Wigelius is he's a super domestique, which basically means his job is to assist and lead out the star riders within pro teams. Basically, they're the ones who do the work but get none of the profile and none of the glamour. I went and interviewed Wigelius after the Tour de France, you know, just at the end, and it had been a really difficult race for him. And really punishing, and their lead rider wasn't particularly pleased with his own performance, so he took it out on the rest of the team. The description of what his life entailed and the kind of punishment physically and emotionally he had to take was just sort of devastating. You couldn't understand how this guy could manage to sit on a bike for 10 minutes every day, let alone kind of 6 or 7 hours every single day, flogging himself mentally.
And nobody notices if he's done a good job, only if he's done a bad job.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly.
So just one last thing I must ask you about is downhill cycling. Have you ever been tempted to do that without brakes? I mean, it's crazy.
Deranged, genuinely deranged. But I think you have to be 20-something and probably male. You know, you invent a bike, you end up on a mountain. What are you going to do? At some point, somebody is going to think, OK, how can we possibly get down this mountain as fast as possible? That's all it is, except that, you know, it's not down a road. It's down a kind of dirt track, if that. On the other hand, it is very enjoyable to watch because they are plain nutters. Yeah, barking, genuinely barking.
Well, that music was quite a bit faster than I can usually cycle. The Bicycle Book is published by Harper Press. And now it's time for me to get back on my bike and head home for the weekend. I'll certainly be putting in some time to read The Guardian Saturday Review, which features a lost short story by Daphne du Maurier. I haven't actually read it yet, but I'm assured it's pretty racy. Joining me here in the studio is Richard Lee from the Books Desk, who's going to fill us in on what else we've got coming up.
Also in review, we've got Will Self writing about growing old. And in the Observer's new review on Sunday, we've got a sporting theme continuing with a new review of a biography of George Best from Barney Ronnie. On our new children's website, we've got an exclusive extract from Patrick Ness's new novel, A Monster Calls. And there's a marvellous discussion going on about pseudonymous literature on the website. We've got up to around 100 comments and they're getting wittier all the time.
What other newspaper has readers who can tell you that Wu Ming means pseudonymous in Chinese?
Or that Mr. Tiptree was a Mrs., in fact.
Or, perhaps best of all, that Edogawa Rampo is a pen name for Hiro Taro, excuse my pronunciation, who is the author of Gothic mystery stories whose name is supposed to sound like a Japanese version of Edgar Allan Poe. Cap that.
Genius.
Thanks there to Tom Learmont, Ms. Lee and Sorge for those pearls of literary wisdom. And please don't forget to become a regular listener and subscribe to get this in your inbox every Friday. Do tell your friends also about it, preferably all around the world. My thanks today to Anthony Bateman, Andy Bull, Bella Bathurst, Richard Lee and our stalwart producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.